You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshie on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Get to people, yeah. What are you gonna you gonna do?
Do you really think that?
Do you think it all?
Yeah. I've never met kids about
you. Ain't giving up a second thought about you. No. Ghetto people.
Who you gonna turn to next?
Tell me. You gotta take a look at yourself, yeah. Get some people.
Where do you wanna be?
Where you wanna
tell
be?
Me what your life is.
What's with your life?
Running like a rare disease.
I'm running like a rare disease. Get some people.
Stop giving up yourself.
Stop doing what you're doing to yourself, young. You gotta learn to love yourself.
You are listening to African Perspectives, where we view the issues of our day from an African worldview and African-centered perspective. This program is unapologetically African. It is a custom in the African tradition to ask elders for permission to speak, having been granted permission. To our ancestors, whose shoulders we stand on, to our elders, whose shadows we walk in, I greet you, my dear brothers and sisters, in the language of one of the greatest civilizations on this planet. It gave the world the basic disciplines of knowledge of science, math, architecture, music, writing, law, religion, you name it, we did it. The Greeks called it Egypt, but they called themselves Kemet, and Kemet means land of the blacks. I greet you all in the Kemetic language, the word of peace, Hotep. It is truly an honor and a privilege to pour libation because we truly do stand on the shoulders of those who came before us. We're going to use water because water has no enemies. Water is the great cleanser, the great purifier. Everything on the planet that lives, it needs water, from a tiny microscopic organism to a tall redwood tree. We pour water into the earth to invoke the spirits of our ancestors, and we say the word Ashe, which simply means so be it. So we pour this libation to God, for all that God has done and for all that God will do. We say, Ashe. We pour this libation to Mother Africa, birthplace of all humanity, everyone who has lived, everyone who will live in the future. We all have a common ancestral root in Africa. We pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. I mentioned Kemet in the opening. Kemet was the height, the apex, the zenith of African high culture. But there were others as well, as Timari, Punt, and Nubia. So we pour this libation to the classical civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa, of Ghana, Mali, Songhai, Benin, Great Zimbabwe. Civilizations that were flourishing and growing while Europe was in a medieval or dark age. The University of Sankore at Timbuktu, an outstanding educational institution. So we pour this libation to the contemporary civilizations of Africa. We say Ashe. We pour this libation to the Ma'afa, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the Infakani, the great tragedy, uprooted out of Africa. Our brothers and sisters lay a carpet along the Atlantic Ocean. We're in North America, South America, Central America, and throughout the diaspora. So we pour this libation to our brothers and sisters who suffered the Ma'afa, the Infakani, the Holocaust of our enslavement, the great tragedy. We pour this libation in their honor and in their memory. We do not know their names, but because of them and their sacrifice, we are here. So we say Ashe. We pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. If you ever heard me do a libation, you will know that we were not slaves. I repeat, we were not slaves. We were captives. What does a captive want to do? Get free. So we pour this libation to all those men and women who fought against enslavement. In fact, I maintain that some of us are more of a slave today than we were in our initial captivity, because some of us are a slave to vice, to corruption, to drugs, sex, and violence. So we pour this libation to those who fought against enslavement. Gabriel Prosser, Nat Turner, Dingmark Vesey, Harriet Tubman. We always resisted, and we will always resist. So we pour this libation in the name and the honor of those men and women who fought against our captivity. We pour this libation to those unborn, those young men and women who will once again lead us back on the stage of human history as a free and proud and productive people. We sashe. We pour this libation to brotherhood and sisterhood, together for the union of family. We need each other. We don't have good family life. There's a saying, conditions shape conduct and consciousness. The conditions in our community are bad. The conduct towards each other is not good. Because why? We lack consciousness. And consciousness is more than just awareness. Consciousness is a deeper understanding of who you are historically, who you are culturally. So once we begin to understand the importance of brotherhood and sisterhood together for the union of family. Brothers and sisters, let us all say, Ashe, Ashe.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Good morning, African world. You are listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. And I am your host, Brother Oshi, Hotep family. Hope everything goes well for you today. Hope you're going to have a great weekend. And I hope you get a chance to do all the things you want to do, should do, must do, can do, and will do. And I hope the weather will be accommodating for you to do it. But of course, if it's not, and it has to get done, you will get it done. And you will do it safely. You'll wear your mask. You'll keep your distance. Your hands is going to be clean. You know, all the things that to make sure that you don't get the corona must be done. And you'll get it done. This is African Perspectives. We're here every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., 10 to 12 Central, 9 to 11 Mountain, or 8 to 10 Pacific, any other time around the world. But if you cannot listen to this program live, you can always go to our archives at timeforanawakening.com. And when you go on there, you'll see at the top of the page, podcasts. Click on that. And then you'll see the drop down, African Perspectives. Click on that, and there will be programs that are dated and titled. So, other programming we have here on Time for an Awakening Media. Once again, this program is every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. Eastern. And all times are going to give our Eastern times. On Mondays, Acres of Diamonds from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern. Acres of Diamonds, public affairs programming out of Philadelphia with Brother Jihad Ahmed. And that's followed by from 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central with Dr. Mawia Kamban and Nataki Kamban. And then that's followed at 9 p.m. from 9 p.m. to 10, Conversations, Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey of Encobra. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Tuesdays. On Thursdays from 7 to 9, Melanin Live with Chief Lance Jones and Sister Benisiwa Ayan. On Friday at 8 p.m. on Friday, if it's Friday and it's 8 p.m., it's Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. That is tonight. And then tomorrow from 4 to 6, Sister Talk with Host Lawanda Chambers. And then from 7 to 9, the Sankofa Elders Council. And on Sunday, if it's 7 p.m. on Sunday, it's Time for an Awakening. Once again with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. And the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We Buy Black. We Buy Black, the largest online marketplace for American African-owned businesses, is WeBuyBlack.com. Get everything you need from American African-owned businesses at WeBuyBlack.com. Bamani Tahimba, Africa for the Africans. And my good brother's going next week on the 2nd to Gambia. Africa for the Africans. And he has a number of trips upcoming to Senegal and Gambia.
Yes, King Selassie.
Sorry about that. Sorry about that. But give Brother Bomani a call at 404-931-9429. That's 404-931-9429. If you want to see pictures of previous tours, go to facebook.com/Bomani. If you want to see videos of previous tours, go to youtube.com/Bomani2007. Rinoco Rashidi. Baba Rinoco was on the webcast yesterday for Mama Bayina Bello. It was really nice. Very good information. Beautiful. Brother Rinoco has a trip in August, August 1st through the 14th, going to Kemet. I'm not sure what the cost is. Let me see if I can get down here. Because it's got great pictures, man. Just some beautiful pictures. Yeah, in fact, man, just looking at the pictures alone. Let me see. $4,200 per person. $4,200. And the flight is on Air Egypt out of New York. Flying out of New York. So the details of, go online. Go to his site, drrinoco.com. Drrinoco.com. And on the homepage, hit the tours, and you'll see one of the pyramids. Hit click on it, and there you'll see all the information as it pertains. And you'll go to the new museum that just opened recently. And, of course, you'll go to all the main sites and the tour. You could cruise down the Nile. Cruise down the Nile. Habashah. HabashahIncorporated.org. HabashahIncorporated.org. Go to HabashahIncorporated.org. Their mission is a Pan-African organization that cultivates leadership in youth families through practical experiences and cultural education, sustainable agriculture, entrepreneurship, holistic health, and technology. The programs they have are Habashah Works, Black to Our Roots, Sustainable Seeds, Golden Growers, and the Urban Green Jobs. And, of course, the Kashi Project that is underway as we're speaking in Ghana. Right now, HabashahWorksIncorporated.org. Check them out. The LEDGE Group. LEDGE Group stands for Land for the Environmental Development of Group Economics. They have a raffle. You can win a safari in Tanzania. You can win a Tanzanian safari. Believe me, I went there. Some nice, beautiful. And, you know, Tanzania is just beautiful. And, of course, they got Zanzibar off the coast, just a little north of the capital, Darul Islam. You know, one lucky person will win a vacation for two with all expenses paid to a seven-day African safari in Ashura, Tanzania, valued at $15,000. It includes airfare and so forth. So the opportunity is fantastic. It is right there. To go to Tanzania, the land of Kilimanjaro, the Serengeti, and the beautiful beaches of Zanzibar. Tanzania offers venture, excitement, and splendor. But of course, the LEDGE Group offers sustainability, food, water, clothing, shelter. They have 12 projects in 6 countries and over 170 employed and over 260 members. Become a part of the LEDGE Group. Also, go online to theledgegroup.com and check out the safari, the opportunity to win a Tanzanian safari. The Saturday seminar on bibiatumi.com. That's bibiatumi.com. A-B-I-B-I-T-U-M-I.com. Bibiatumi.com. Tomorrow's Saturday seminar, Integration, Apartheid, and Untouchability. Join Odubale Kamban as he discusses the problematic tradition in which integration is to occur between anyone who happens to be on the African continent without regard for whether or not such integration is in the ultimate interest of African people. Integration has been offered as a solution for anti-African genocide. This is going to be a very lively conversation. I'm trying to register now. I tried to register the other day, but believe me, it's only $10, brothers and sisters. 9 a.m. Eastern, 8 Central, 7 Mountain, and 6 Pacific. That's AM. All right. That's bibiatumi.com. Also, too, they're offering all kinds of courses there. They have offering all kinds of courses in languages, you know. Kiswahili, Yoruba, Fanti. So, the Medu Netcher. So you can learn all of these things on bibiatumi.com. And there's so much more. Brothers and sisters, go to bibiatumi.com. Sun Goddess Sense, your one-stop natural shop. Located at 4140 Jonesboro Road in Forest Park, Georgia. Inside the International Discount Mall. That's Sun Goddess Sense, your one-stop natural shop. And for more information, contact Sister Shirley Amonsette at 404-434-7963. That's 404-434-7963. Wadada's Healthy Marketing Juice Bar, located in the West End, across the street from the Soul Veg, down the street from the Shrine of the Black Madonna, which is open here in Atlanta from 1 to 7 on Saturday. Excuse me, today, Friday, and Saturday. Also, to the bookstore, the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall, Mama Nia's. She's right on the main thoroughfare now. She is open, and the number to call is 404-346-3263. She has a fine selection of books, greeting cards, postcards, all kinds of figurines, and T-shirts, and all kinds of good stuff. That's the Medu Bookstore in the Greenbrier Mall. The other bookstore we promote is the Black Dot Cultural Center Bookstore in Lithonia, which is east of here in Atlanta, off of I-20. And Gazimde Ajamu, the proprietor, has expanded. I mean, that place looks really nice, brother. It really does. They have a coffee bar, and they serve delicious Cameroon boil, as well as other African and other coffees and teas and pastries and all kinds of good stuff. And, of course, if they don't have the book that you're looking for, they'll get it for you. If you give them a call at 404-519-8107, that's 404-519-8107, the Black Dot Cultural Center and Bookstore. Us Lifting Us, the Economic Development Cooperative for our people. Their Thursday night broadcast went off last night. I listened to it. And Us Lifting Us, Brother Shabaka, outstanding job of explaining sustainability, how important it is for us as African people. Go to blogtalkradio.com/ULU, Us Lifting Us, their Thursday night broadcast, every Thursday night at 9 p.m. Eastern. 9 p.m. Eastern. The number to call is 929-477-2789. That's 929-477-2789. Us Lifting Us. Sister Gabby Aurelia with Sanjay-Haiti.org. Go to Sanjay-Haiti.org. Sonjay-Aiti.org. Sanjay-Haiti.org. Akaban Institute. The Akaban Institute, where Baba Baruti and his lovely wife, Mama Ya, have been teaching our young warriors. They need support. If you into sending a check, please do so. Make it out to Akaban Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. That's Akaban Institute, P.O. Box 10786, Atlanta, Georgia, 30310. You can use Cash App and PayPal. The Cash App, the dollar sign, Yah, the letter M, and then Baruti, B-A-R-U-T-I, and make your constant donations. Greatly appreciated. And, of course, Baba Baruti is a prolific writer. You can check his books out at AkabanHouse.com. AkabanHouse.com. All right. The Inye Sesim of Daily Revolutionary Thought. And, of course, on Fridays, I read yesterday, today, and tomorrow's. Always read on three on Fridays. So, March 25th. When the rot is evident at the top, nothing below shall be surprising. Wole Yosinga. St. Cain's. Wole Soyinka. When using ugliness as the universal standard of beauty, that which is held as a timeless divine attractivity becomes the embodiment of ugliness, except it to be portrayed as particularly exotic. When using evilness as a standard of morality, that which is divinely righteous becomes evil. When using perversion as a standard of normalcy, that which expresses universal normality becomes perverse. It is only because of our, it is only because of our captive, envy-inducing presence among Urugu that we have become so thoroughly confused as to imagine the heinous lovely. It is only since we have accepted our look as the ugliest people of all, as missing from any scale of natural beauty, that we have aspired to look deficient. It is only after having succumbed to their blind envy that we have accepted their tactical definition of us as unsightly as deserved. Only then we have dutifully come to welcome our inevitable role as relatively worthless sub-participants in their reality. Only an implanted self-hatred has caused so many of us to become whatever we think is them and hide ourselves underneath their repulsive, degenerate ugliness. It is only since we have traded timeless spiritual practices and principles for the religious doctrine of empire that we have twisted so much evil into what only evil could describe as good. It is only in their presence that an ugliness of appearance and soul have become misinterpreted as deserving adoration and deemed worthy of emulation. Affirm, I do not envy or imitate rot. Affirm, I do not envy or imitate rot. March 26. It is not enough to understand. We must have the power to real. We must have the power of realization. Once again, it is not enough to understand. We must have the power of realization. Ra Arnefer Aman, the Shekama Shekama. Ra Arnefer Aman. Warriors have clarity. And even though these are separate issues in terms of the message needed to be conveyed, they know that they have responsibility to make African people and our enemies understand our situation as well as what must be done to correct it. Realization, however, is another issue. It remains unattained because much of their energy is consumed in fighting the crippling menticide they harbor and that they feed among our people. This internalized self-defeating self-hatred hampers unbridled courage. And this directly interferes with true realization. True realization knows neither excuses nor stunting qualifications. Most warriors understand that they must speak to the people, friend or foe, in the language they understand in order for them to be understood. They also know that silence also speaks. So while they have no conversation for murderers of our people, they know that they must somehow be made to grasp the horror of the Ma'afa so they can see that they are unforgivable and must unforgivable and they must somehow be made to grasp the horror of the Ma'afa so they can see that they are unforgivable and must reciprocally be destroyed in order to return order to Ashaya. This position will never come in the form of words because we know that the human speech is incapable of expressing this level of righteous rage. Moreover, the wrong of what they have done is so far beyond their comprehension and admittance that using words to communicate it to them would make us again fools. Nevertheless, once warriors fully understand and make themselves completely understood, realization will naturally come. Affirm. My understanding and actualizations are inseparable. Affirm, my understanding and actualizations are inseparable. March 27. The question then seems not whether or not critical approach is political, but whose politics it represents. Fred Lee Hoard. Every utterance, every thought, every behavior is political. Therefore, withholding or being withheld judgment because we did not and in all probability will never know the real thoughts of the menticitis twirling around us leaves us defenseless against those who are intent on infusing confusion into our lives. Such a mentality leaves you unable to effectively throw stones at those who would kill your spirit and or would physical manifestation without punctuation. It leaves you without the ability to sanely pursue life in a reality built on death. It may give you a sense of fairness, of momentary righteous balance, but it leaves you defenseless against the inheritors and carriers of derangement and their menticidal mercenary pets. Right or wrong, everyone judges. There is far too much uncertainty and stimuli in any society not to. Moreover, even if this were not the case, everything is still political, even our so-called objectivity. So never be afraid to judge what is wrong as long as that judgment favors African people as we naturally are. Worrying about any error in judgment can wait until the wrong rights itself. Speaking of judgment, our personal power over our uncompromising center interpretations of reality should extend far beyond ourselves to everything we encounter. As such, there is absolutely no reason why Urugu should not be judged as one. Some would argue that this makes us prejudiced because it is a collective judgment of individuals. However, this argument is unscientific because we cannot be prejudiced against Urugu. Prejudice is to judge with no prior knowledge. We know them. We know who Urugu is. Affirm, my politics are purely African. Ashe. Affirm, my politics are purely African. The Nyasasim of daily revolutionary thought. Want to thank you, our listeners, for this past Wednesday when I paid some tribute to Elgin Baylor, who passed away this past Monday. And who was somebody who was special to me as I grew up. I loved Elgin Baylor, loved the Lakers. And of course, this is March Madness. And so the games begin again tomorrow and Sunday and Monday and Tuesday, I think. So because it's tomorrow, Sweet 16, you got to get to Sweet 16, and then you got to go to the Elite Eight. And from the Elite Eight, you got to go to the Final Four, which will be next week, Saturday and Monday. And of course, next week is Good Friday. Next Friday is Good Friday. And I'm going to have a good program. It's going to be a good program. I hope you get a chance to listen. But I always want you to keep this in mind as you watch the March Madness. March Madness really is a stirring reminder of what America was founded on, making tons of money off the labor of unpaid African people. Because it's March Madness for men and for women. And neither get paid. But yet, they make, for the women, millions. For the men, they make billions. Billions of dollars. I hope my guest is ready. Brother Akil Parker, are you there?
Good morning, brother.
Hey, my brother. How are you? How you been?
I've been good. How you been?
I've been well, man. I've been doing well. Yeah, I know this is Women's Month, so we decided to. In fact, we were trying to do this particular program on Asada Shakur, but just, you know, things happen. I know you, I think
yeah,
you.
Yeah, this is like Last July, we did
right.
on Ida B. Wells Barnett. We
right.
were going to do a top four, and then, you know, life got happened.
Yeah.
Know?
Well.
So, but better late than never.
That's for sure. And it's appropriate, you know.
Yeah.
So to focus on this sister who has gone through a lot and who now is living in Cuba. She is being protected by the Cuban government and told Barack Obama, no, we ain't giving her up, you know? And I'm quite sure there have been many attempts to try to persuade somebody by offering them money and of course trying to plant somebody there to even maybe even take her out, you know, but right. She's being protected, so we appreciate that, you know.
Yeah, definitely. And one of the things I didn't know, because of course, like the autobiography, you know, that came out in like 1980, that was published in 1987, Asada, which I recommend to everybody that hasn't read it, students, adults, I mean, young people, adults, everybody just the same, is that like she was actually, I didn't know she was actually underground after the escape in the United States.
Yes.
You know, for like 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah, before I thought, she made a move.
And in my mind, I like constructed my own narrative in my own mind. I knew she escaped from prison with the aid of some Black Liberation Army members.
Right.
And then I knew she ended up in Cuba. But my assumption was always that, like, you know, like kind of like in the movies, like, you know, you escape from prison and you're out. You know, you leave. You know, get on a plane and, you know, out. But that says a lot, too, that she was able to exist underground for several years before, mm-hmm. you know, going to fleeing to Cuba under the protection of Fidel Castro and his regime. And that's, you know, that's just something that, you know, people have to think about critically when they, again, in terms of media literacy, when they hear stories about people like Fidel Castro and how he's this like evil communist dictator and whatnot. And even if he, you know, the man doesn't have to be perfect, but when you think about, okay, he did allow, you know, for and facilitate Asada Shakur, provide her political asylum, you know, in his nation. You know, these are the connections that we have to make when we're thinking critically and when we make our assessments, you know, of people, especially when people are vilified within the Western mainstream media.
Right.
You know?
Well, you know, for me, I've always, not necessarily always, in my conscious years of my life, which is like, what am I, 70, 40 years or more, always, if white folks are mad about it, I'm happy. You know, if they say it's this, I say it's that, you know. And so, you know, as it relates to Fidel Castro and the hatred towards him, and how many times they tried to kill that man? About 100, over 100 times they tried to kill him, exploding cigars and all kind of madness. Of course, the Bay of Pigs, you know. And so, and he's come here, and when he came here, he wasn't received by the U.S. government. He was received by revolutionaries and received by brothers and sisters that, like Malcolm at the Teresa Hotel, you know.
People in the streets. Yeah, people in the hood.
Yeah, you know.
You know.
And
he said he was a force of nature. He said he was a force of nature. He said that's why they can't kill me.
Yeah. Well, you know, and then when he did die, and I know we're going to talk about Asada Shakur, but very, very, very briefly, when he did die, there were many Caucasian Cubans. That's what I call them. Because these were the Cubans that did not want to live in a society of equality with other people because they had privilege. They had plantations. They had African Cubans, Cuban Africans, in servitude. They didn't want to, you know, so he came in, he educated everybody. Cuba's the most literate country in this hemisphere. Cuba's medical practices are the best in this hemisphere, you know. And so, yet, when he did die, those Cubans in South Florida, in fact, the people who go to school in Cuba, to their medical school, and I, in fact, when I was visiting Cuba, I visited the medical school. And a sister from Milwaukee, she was in the school at the time, Joya Mosley. And, you know, and there was a lot of students from out west, particularly the Oakland area, you know. And there's only one place that you cannot take the medical bar, you know, your medical license. That's Florida. You can't take it in Florida. So you can get your license in Cuba, but you can't practice in Florida. You can go probably other states and take your test. You pass, you can practice. But in Florida, you cannot even practice. You can't even go there because of Fidel Castro and Cuba, you know. And so when he passed, they were celebrating. You know, I remember a couple of Cubans on TV, you know, who are Caucasian Cubans, all teary-eyed and happy that he died and sad that they left Cuba because they didn't want to live under socialism. They didn't want to share. They wanted to continue the privilege that they had, you know. So right. My hat's off to
Hollywood. You know, Hollywood, just a little bit about that. Hollywood depicted that, too. I think it was Godfather Part Two. You know, it showed the Corleone family. They had a lot of business and quote unquote investments in Cuba. Cuba was like Las Vegas.
Right. You know, exactly. It was.
Before Castro and them, mm-hmm. Juan Almeida, Che Guevara and them. And I did some research on actually Juan Almeida because he was a, you know, you look at pictures of him and he was a brother. You know,
okay.
So you see it. Look at him and he was right there with them, you know, in that group of 80 mm-hmm. that was able to overthrow the Batista regime and you know, kind of take the land over for the people and nationalize everything and told them, you know, Western corporations and U.S. corporations, like, y'all got to go. Mm-hmm. Y'all got to get up out of here because y'all exploiting us.
Mm-hmm.
We want a more fair and equitable society. We want a more fair and equitable economic system, political system, and all that. And, you know, it wasn't, like I said, it's not perfect. You know, people have, you know, talked about a lot of, you know, colorism and racism in Cuba. But, you know, I think it's a work in progress.
Always.
You know, at least progress, yeah. Working toward a more egalitarian and, you know, equitable society. I just hope that since Castro has left in the physical, hope that it hasn't, you know, regress too much. And also, you know, because Castro, him passing away also has led to, in part, like, why, like, Assad Shakur, you know, doesn't get to, like, really travel freely, you know, from what I've heard, you know,
okay.
Of course, get to travel freely as she once did, you know, in the country and in the nation. And then you have, like, you know, the United States government increasing the bounty on her head because at one point it was, in 2005, it was $1 million.
Now it's two.
In 2013, it got increased by 100% to $2 million.
Yeah.
You know, so it just lets you know, you know, what, you know, these people represent and what she was doing and what her collective, you know, the Black Liberation Army and what they were about and how significant they were, how, you know, similar to Mumia Abu-Jamal, where, you know, they tried to assassinate her in 1973. On the New Jersey Turnpike on May 2nd, 1973. Shot her twice. She got shot mm-hmm. twice. And, you know, yeah. Medical exam proved that, you know, the way the bullet went into her, one bullet went into her arm and the other went into her other shoulder, that she had to have had her hands up. So she was in defense and in surrender. And then they claim that, you know, as soon as the troopers pulled up, they started shooting from out the car, shooting at the cops from the car. But, you know, they always, you know, just make up any story they need to.
Sure.
You know, solidify their position. But, yeah, you know, an attempted assassination attempt on her life. Also on that of Sundiata Okoli, which is one of my intellectual heroes, because Sundiata Okoli was another member of the Black Liberation Army that also was a mathematician. So when I think about, you know, I'm promoting
oh, right
all
on.
This.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and he studied computer science. Mm-hmm. Down at Prairie View A&M.
Oh, okay.
Prairie View A&M was a historically Black college.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the 1950s, 1960s, he got his degree and he was a computer scientist and mathematician. And I think that's the same school that, I want to say, Jacob Carruthers, one of the founding members of ASCAP.
Yes, sir.
Association for Studies of Classical African Civilizations, you know, that he either graduated from or taught at. Mm-hmm. This first place he taught at, I'm not sure. But, you know, there's so many connections. That's why I like going down these rabbit holes and studying the history, because then you make all these connections. And, like, you know, everybody's connected some kind of way.
Yeah.
But, yeah, Sundiata Okoli is still a political prisoner.
Right.
Like, right now, he's still a political prisoner behind that situation. Unfortunately, the third person, Zaid Malik Shakur, who was also in the car, he was murdered. He was
right.
Murdered by the state troopers. So they murdered him. He died. Then they, you know, so of course, Assad Shakur got shot twice. And, you know, and then, you know, she was brutalized on her way to the hospital, you know, when she was in the hospital, brutalized by the cops, you know, and whatnot, while she was under custody, you know. So, you know, and then, you know, that, of course, that connects her to, I think about, when I hear about that, I think about all the women that have been, all the Black women that have been brutalized by law enforcement and by the prison industrial complex, and even like people like Fannie Lou Hamer, you know, who was brutalized in the jail in Mississippi, you know, for in connection to her activism work and her, you know, her struggle against oppression. So
Fannie Lou Hamer. They always use her quote. I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired, but I like her. Yeah. I like her quote, which was to me more profound, is that never forget where you came from and always praise the bridges that carried you over. You know, I love that because that's what we should do. We should never forget who we are, and we should always praise our ancestors who brought us this far, you know. And she was a dynamic. All of them sisters, I pray be paying tribute to all of these sisters who have done great things to help liberate our people and continue the struggle of our people, you know.
Definitely. You know, and Asada Shakur, like so many, would be classified as suffering from drapetomania.
That's right, running away from captivity. You must be insane to run away from my captivity.
Exactly. So if the listening audience is not familiar with drapetomania, like we say it jokingly, but you know, from studying books like Medical Apartheid by Harriet Washington, she documents how so-called doctors, or you know, pseudoscientists or whatever you want to call them, from the 19th century and the 18th century in America, what they did was they tried to discourage running away from the plantation, because of course, you know, if you run away from the plantation, I mean, you're an asset, you know, as an enslaved African, not a slave, but as an enslaved African, to be clear about that.
That's right.
The terminology. If you run away, that represents a loss in profit. So we want to discourage that any type of way, so that that enslaved African gets diagnosed with a sickness. Mm-hmm. So the sickness they came up with was drapetomania, meaning that you believe that you should run away, that you should be free. So as a person of African descent, if you believe that you should be free, you run away. They classify that as the sickness.
Mm.
So it really gets into like power and who has the ability to create definitions. Because when we start to accept other people's, like, it's like John Henry Clark said, you know, power is the ability, or maybe not John.
I'm thinking
of Bobby Seale. Power is the ability to define phenomena and make it act in a desired manner. Many people have, you know, had these kind of synonymous.
Right, that's just like Wade Nobles. Yeah. When I first heard it, I thought it was the most definitive definition of power. Because, you know, people always talk about, we're going to empower the people. You always heard that, you know, this program will empower us, you know. And it ain't going to do a damn thing, okay? It ain't going to do sugar, honey, iced tea. Because in this society, what power is the ability to, this is what Wade Nobles, power is the ability to define reality, then have others accept your definition as if it's their own. Europeans define reality, and then they impose it on others, and the others have accepted their definition as if it's their own. And that's why we're in this disgusting, terrible state that we're in. We're in the Europeans' reality. But the question that we need to ask ourselves is, who are we in Europeans' reality? First, we were the soulless people, no culture to speak of, justifying and legitimizing our captivity, because we had no culture, you know. We can go ahead and do what they want to do to us, you know. And then, but who are we in their reality today? We're thugs, drug addicts, no fit fathers, no fit mothers, you know, justifying our imprisonment, justifying our mistreatment, you know, because this is their reality. And so we must say, we must define and shape reality in our image and our interests. And so to me, that definition of defining reality is cool, but I don't want to impose it on nobody. So that last part of the definition to, you know, make others accept it as their own, I don't want nobody to accept my reality. But I want to live in my reality, and I don't want nobody imposing theirs on me. You know?
Yeah. So with the drapetomania, I mean, you talk about, you know, in slavery as an institution and as a economic system, as a social system, you know, and they, you know, create a reality where people of African descent are destined, and, you know, almost through divine order, as they would say, to be enslaved by Europeans. then if you say, if you as a human being, you exercise some type of agency and some type of intelligence and say, no, I should not, you know, I should not be a slave. You know, it's kind of like, you know, Frederick Douglass, you know, he's learning how to read. And then, you know, his temporary owner tells his wife while she's trying to teach him how to read, like, he'll be unfit to be a slave, uh-huh. You know, if you do that. So, you know, it's like, you know, that reality of, okay, well, you know, he's you know, we need to be enslaved. So if we are not enslaved, then something is wrong. Because we're compromising the reality that they have, created.
That's right, that they have created.
Promoted.
That's right.
You know? So yeah, you know, just but her, the thing is, you know, one of the many reasons, you know, I have a lot of love for this sister is because she's still a runaway slave to this day.
That's right.
Right now, as you speak.
That's right.
You know, for years, you know, since 1979, mm-hmm. She was November 2nd, 1979. That should be a holiday, actually. Now that I think mm-hmm. about it, you know, November 2nd, 1979, the day that Assata Shakur escaped from bondage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's definitely influenced my life a lot, my personal life. I remember when I was, as a teacher, trying to become more culturally aware, more politically aware, and realizing that, you know, being a math teacher, being a high school math teacher is much, mm-hmm. much deeper than X's and Y's and solving equations and teaching the students how to solve equations. But it's about helping them to develop their critical thinking through the practice of working out math problems and understanding, learning how to read and decipher information and then use it to then solve problems to be outside of the classroom in their own life. So, you know, mm-hmm. my reading increased at one point significantly. And one of the books I read was Assata, you know, her autobiography influenced me so greatly. My daughter, my second child, you know, I named her, well, her government name was supposed to be Assata, but, uh-huh. you know, her mom called the audible the day she was born. So that's not her government name. So Assata became her middle name, which is okay. Cool because I still call her Assata. So I try to evoke, you okay. know, Assata Shakur whenever I'm speaking to my daughter, and my daughter knows, you know, she knows who her namesake is.
I say,
you know, she's been educated in that way. And, you know, and just thinking about the book, there was a line, you know, how, like, you read certain books and then certain lines from books that just resonate with you.
That's right. You know, I agree.
And so many quotables in this book, mm-hmm. so many key elements to this book. But one of the things that stood out to me, because I was also a teacher in the Upward Bound program. I taught it at different Upward Bound programs. I taught it the high school Upward Bound program here in Philly at Temple University for about a year and a half. Also taught in the Upward Bound program later at University of Pennsylvania. You know, one of those, you know, racist Ivy League institutions. Well, Temple's racist too, but, you know, that's the topic of another episode. But but the Upward Bound programs, you know, where they take young people, you know, first generation college students, and the means to expose them to college and to, you know, provide them with academic support to supplement what they're doing in their high schools Monday through Friday, which is positive. That's very positive. But it's about, you know, what Assata Shakur talked about in her autobiography was she was critiquing neocolonialism. And this is the thing that I think is a huge problem for us, because the term neocolonialism itself is not even in our general everyday vocabulary. It really needs to be, because neocolonialism is a system that governs so much of our experience, especially when we talk about schooling, or if you want to call it, we could call it education, but it's more so schooling, right? Because the purpose of Upward Bound programs by those that have established them on the governmental side, right? Not to say that every teacher or every administrator or director of an Upward Bound program has this goal. Some of them may, and some of them definitely do, but they're get out of the hood programs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not only get out of the hood
programs,
they're programs meant to, right. you know, separate you
right.
and create these cleavages between the so-called educated blacks. And this is what Woodson talked about this in great detail in Miseducation of the Negro. These programs are meant to separate certain members of the black community or the black collective from the masses of the black collective. And it's similar to, like, you know, how, you know, Lincoln and them was trying to do with the American Colonization Society, talking about, you know, expatriation back in the day. Because, you know, again, you know, leaving America and going to Africa is not a problem. But the question is, who's promoting this idea And what did they have to benefit from it? Like, mm-hmm. cui bono, like that Latin phrase, who benefits? Who's it good for, right? So it's the same thing. It's like it's a separation element. Because, you know, what Lincoln and them was trying to do is, like, they just wanted slavery to exist, you know, in its, you know, more efficiently and more easily for them. Because you got to get rid of these so-called educated blacks that could be the abolitionists, you know, that could right. make waves and trouble, you know, or could be going back to the plantation and, you know, helping people escape. So we got to get rid of all them, and then we can have a more efficient institution of chattel slavery, and everything will be right. cool. So now, even today, you have upward bound programs where, you know, and a lot of programs that are funded by the government. And not to say that you shouldn't take advantage of these programs, definitely take advantage of them, you know, because they're paid by your tax dollars anyway, right? It's not a handout. You know, we got to talk about that. Like, you can't, you know, if I'm putting money into a pot, and then I want to benefit from a program that is financed by that money that I've been throwing into the pot all along, that's right. not a handout. That's my own money.
That's right.
The community money. The government right. doesn't have its own money.
No, it doesn't. The government gets money from the citizenry exactly. through a number of ways. So it is ours. It's just like the other programs. These aren't, you know, no, our tax dollars have paid for these programs, and they're legitimate for us to take advantage of.
Right. You know? So, again, like, you know, with upward bound programs or any type, you know, these programs, provided by different nonprofits, or as some people talk about, the nonprofit industrial complex, and they're funded by, you know, grants and government grants. So sure, by all means, take advantage of them. But again, it goes back to, like, you know, the cultural grounding and the political grounding that we have to have so that we're not. You know, our children don't grow up and become weaponized against the black community or against the black collective. And that's mm-hmm. that's one of the things that she talked about that always stood out against me. Right. It made me sit and think, like, wow, this upward bound program, it's meant to take people out of the inner city, out of the urban area, provide them with formal education, hopefully a college degree. But with that college degree and with that training, we have to think about what type of academic training are they getting? Are they getting the type of, because many times we get the type of training that even I was subject to this. I'm speaking from firsthand experience. You know, I'm making a critique, but this is a self-directed critique as well. This is the type of training that Carter G. Woodson talked about
That's
in
right.
the miseducation of
That's
people,
right.
very in a very detailed manner. He talked about this. So these programs are meant to not change anything, but maintain the status quo mm-hmm. and keep us, you know, it's like Amos Wilson. You know, Amos Wilson talked about, again, one of the things that I always remember from him, his lectures and his writing, we're being trained to be the black face of white power.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to think about that when we get into these. And these are the things that, you know, and this is why she was so dangerous, because these are the thoughts that she had and the analysis that she had. And she also had the courage to come out and say it. And not only that, be in community with other brothers and sisters that felt the same way. So they created this type of synergy, and they were influential to many other people. Mm-hmm. Which, of course, is going to be a problem, you know, when black people start organizing around, you know, common ideas and ideas that actually make sense and ideas that, like, upset the status quo. So that's why, you know, definitely another reason why I have a lot of love for this sister. Mm-hmm. Even so much that, you know, my baby girl, you know, I named her after her, you know.
I got
a picture of her on my wall in my house, you know, and everything.
Yeah.
You know, she's definitely one of my revolutionary heroes.
Yeah, when
that's
you're
why
real.
I wanted to come on here and talk about her. You
right
know?
On, one of your real sheroes. Definitely.
Yeah, she
deserving
enough.
So.
You know, definitely doesn't get discussed enough. Yeah. So we gotta have more conversations among ourselves, and, you know, even just in the house, you know, even if it's not on social media or it's not mm-hmm. promoted, you know, in the you know, with more publicity. Even if you're just in the car driving somewhere with your child, you know, we gotta start talking about these people.
Well,
you know,
to me,
you're not gonna hear about it in school.
Right. You're not gonna hear about those who are defiant, those who are resisting, those who are fighting back. You're not gonna hear so much. Cause even for me, in my schooling of the 50s and 60s, you know, there was nobody. You didn't hear about Frederick Douglass. You didn't hear about Sojourner Truth or Harriet Tubman. The only person you heard about was Booker T. Washington and George Washington Carver, because they didn't want to talk about anybody who resisted, anybody who had a, if you were were staunch integrationists, if you were staunch believing that, you know, we're thankful for Europeans bringing us over here and exposing us to Western ideas and to Western religion, Christianity, and so forth, and all praise, and we're just so thankful, you heard about that. But if you heard about somebody challenging that, no, you're not going to hear about that. You know, that was all the way up into high school, man. And in high school, we marched out of class. I remember distinctively, we coordinated a whole thing, not just the high school I was at, but the other high schools in our community as well. Because Milwaukee has always been and continues to be one of the most segregated communities in this country. And I'm quite sure a lot of cities can say the same thing, you know. But we understood that we need our history to be taught to us as well. And so finally, my senior year, they did have a course that they had developed, you know, but, you know, and even at that, you know, they ain't going to want to talk about, you know, Pan-Africanism. They're not going to talk about those who are challenging a corrupt, evil system that it has been in existence now for hundreds of years that has benefited Europeans to the detriment of everybody else. They, you know, they ain't going to talk about that. See? Yes, part of dreptomania. Yeah.
I got a pamphlet here actually that I got from an elder when I was involved with the All African People's Revolutionary Party. Mm-hmm. You know, originally founded by Kwame Osagyefo,
right?
Kwame
Nkrumah. Yeah.
Voted by another one of my intellectual revolutionary heroes, Kwame Ture, who I named my third child. You know, Kwame. I named him after him. But it's a pamphlet that was is dated from 1974, and it's published by the Black Liberation Army, and you know, I got this from one of my elders. I wanted to read directly like the words of Asada Shakur from this, but you know, are you taking a commercial break anytime?
Yeah,
soon,
I'm going to take a commercial break right now. So when we come back from the break, you can get that ready, and we'll you can read that and we'll discuss that. And of course, you brothers and sisters who are in the queue, if you wanted to ask a question, a comment, or concern, you can just hit star twice and you'll get in, or just dial 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. You're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network, on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. My guest today is Brother Akil Parker out of Philly, and we're talking about Sister Asada Shakur. Be right back. You stay with us.
You are listening to African Perspectives with host Brother Oshi on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Yeah.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters. Once again, you're listening to African Perspectives here on the Motherland Media Network on timeforanawakening.com and blacktalkradionetwork.com. Mandrell, Fence Walk, 1972, but I'm 70 music is just, to me, it's bombing, man. I tell you, I love it. It's me. Other programming that we have here on Time for an Awakening Media, of course, on Mondays, Acres of Diamonds, public affairs programming out of Philadelphia with Brother Jahad Ahmed from 6 to 8. Acres of Diamonds. That's followed by from 8 to 9, Black Therapy Central with Dr. Mawia Cambon and Nataki Cambon. And then at from 9 to 10, Conversations, Reparations with Brother Jamoke and Sister Lacey of Encobra. On Tuesdays, Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers at from 8 to 10. On Thursdays from 7 to 9, Melanin Live with Chief Lance Jones and Sister Benisi Y. Ayan. And then on Fridays, if it's Friday and it's 8 p.m., it's Time for an Awakening with Brother Elliot and Brother Richard at 8 p.m. on Fridays. And Saturday, from 4 to 6 on Saturdays, Sister Talk with host LaWanda Chambers. And then from 7 to 9 on Saturday, the Sankofa Elders Council. The Sankofa Elders Council. And then on Sunday at 7 p.m., once again, it's Time for an Awakening. And the number to call is 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. We're talking today with my good brother, Akil Parker, educator, mathematician, and all kinds of good stuff, researcher, historian. I love him. Brother Akil, you said you had something for
us. Yes, sir.
That you want to read to us. And so go ahead, my brother.
Yeah, so this is a pamphlet dated 1974 from the Black Liberation Army. Because, again, what we also want to do in terms of historiography is, you know, what Western historiography does is it creates these like supermen and superwomen, right? Mm-hmm. That were like these individuals that stood, you know, on their own and did all these things, you know, that are very, you know, impressive to us and extraordinary. And, you know, many of these people did do extraordinary things, but we, you know, from the African-centered worldview, we think about the community that they were a part of, because nobody stands alone. No person is like, you know, self-made, like, you know, Rick Ross and these commercial rappers try to tell us and tell our children, but we're all parts of community. Right. Community strengthens us, so where we work in a community and it makes us stronger. Right. So the Black Liberation Army, after she left the Black Panther Party and kind of, you know, went on to the Black Liberation Army, like many people did, they had, you know, literature, propaganda, you know, positive propaganda, a pamphlet called Break the Chains. And this particular pamphlet, there's writing by Zaid Malik Shakur, who was murdered on the New Jersey Turnpike by the state troopers, New Jersey state troopers. Also, Sundiata Kohli, he writes in this as well. And then she has an entry in here as well, entitled To My People. And she says, Black brothers, Black sisters, I want you to know that I love you, and I hope that somewhere in your heart you have love for me. My name is Asada Shakur, slave name Joanne Chesimard, and I am a revolutionary, a Black revolutionary. By that, I mean that I'm a field nigger who is determined to be free by any means necessary. By that, I mean that I have declared war on all forces that have raped our women, castrated our men, and kept our babies empty bellied. I have declared war on the rich who prosper on our poverty, the politicians who lie to us with smiling faces, and all the mindless, heartless robots who protect them and their property. I am a Black revolutionary, and as such, I am the victim of all the wrath, hatred, and slander that America is capable of. Like all other Black revolutionaries, I have been hunted like a dog, and like all other Black revolutionaries, America is trying to lynch me. I'm a Black revolutionary woman, and because of this, I've been charged with and accused of every alleged crime in which a woman was believed to have participated, the alleged crimes in which only men were supposedly involved. I have been accused of planning. They have plastered pictures alleged to be me in post offices, airports, hotels, police cars, subways, banks, televisions, and newspapers. They have offered over $50,000 in rewards for my capture, and they have issued orders to shoot on sight and shoot to kill. I am a Black revolutionary, and by definition, that makes me part of the Black Liberation Army. The pigs have used their newspapers and TVs to paint the Black Liberation Army as vicious, brutal, mad dog criminals. They have called us gangsters and gun moles and have compared us to such characters as John Dillinger and Ma Barker. It should be clear. It must be clear to anyone who can think, see, or hear that we are the victims and not the criminals. It should also be clear to us by now who the real criminals are. Nixon and his crime partners have murdered hundreds of third world brothers and sisters in Vietnam, Cambodia, Mozambique, Angola, and South Africa. As was proved by the Watergate, the top law enforcement officials in this country are a lying bunch of criminals. The president, two attorney generals, the head of the FBI, the head of the CIA, and half the White House staff have been implicated in the Watergate crimes. They call us murderers, but we did not murder over 250 unarmed black men, women, and children, and wound thousands of others in the riots they provoked during the 60s. The rulers of this country have always considered their property more important than our lives. They call us murderers, but we were not responsible for the 28 brother inmates and the 9 hostages murdered at Attica. They call us murderers, but we did not hold over 30 unarmed black students at Jackson State or Southern State either. They call us murderers, but we did not murder Martin Luther King, Emmett Till, Medgar Evers, Malcolm X, George Jackson, Nat Turner, James Chaney, and countless other black freedom fighters. We did not bomb 4 black little girls in a Sunday school. We did not murder by shooting in the back 16-year-old Rita Lloyd, 11-year-old Ricky Bowden, or 10-year-old Clifford Glover. They call us murderers, but we do not control or enforce a system of racism and oppression that systematically murders black and third world people. Although black people supposedly comprise about 15% of the total American population, at least 60% of murder victims are black. For every pig that is killed in the so-called line of duty, there are at least 50 black people murdered by police. Black life expectancy is much lower than white, and they do their best to kill us before we are born. We are burned alive in fire-trapped tenements. Our brothers and sisters OD daily from heroin and methadone. Our babies die from lead poisoning. Millions of black people have died as a result of indecent medical care. This is murder. But they have the gall to call us murderers. They call us kidnappers, yet Brother Clark Squire, later changed his name to Sundiata Kohli, who was accused along with me of murdering a New Jersey state trooper, was kidnapped on April 2nd, 1969 from our black community and held on $100,000 ransom in the New York Panther 21 conspiracy case. He was acquitted on May 13th, 1971, along with all the others of all the 156 counts of conspiracy by a jury that took less than 2 hours to deliberate. Brother Squire was innocent, yet he was kidnapped from his community and family. Over 2 years of his life was stolen, but they call us kidnappers. They call us kidnappers, but we did not kidnap the thousands of brothers and sisters held captive in America's concentration camps. 90% of the prison population in this country are black and third world people who can afford neither bail nor lawyers. They call us thieves and bandits. They say we steal. But it was not us who stole millions of black people from the continent of Africa. We were robbed of our language, of our gods, of our culture, of our human dignity, of our labor, and of our lives. They call us thieves, yet it is not us who rip off billions of dollars every year through tax evasions, illegal price fixing, embezzlement, consumer fraud, bribes, kickbacks, and swindles. They call us bandits, yet every time most black people pick up our paychecks, we are being robbed. Every time we walk into a store in our neighborhood, we are being held up. And every time we pay our rent, the landlord sticks a gun into our ribs. They call us thieves, but we did not rob and murder millions of Indians by ripping off their homeland, then call ourselves pioneers. They call us bandits, but it is not us who are robbing Africa, Asia, and Latin America of their natural resources and freedom while the people are sick and starving. The rulers of this country and their flunkies have committed some of the most brutal, vicious crimes in history. They are the bandits. They are the murderers, and they should be treated as such. These maniacs are not fit to judge me, Clark Squire, or any other black person on trial in America. Black people should and inevitably must determine our destinies. Every revolution in history has been accomplished by actions, although words are necessary. We must create shields that protect us and spears that penetrate our enemies. Black people must learn how to struggle by struggling. We must learn by our mistakes. I want to apologize to you, my black brothers and sisters, for being on the New Jersey Turnpike. I should have known better. The turnpike is a checkpoint where black people are stopped, searched, harassed, and assaulted. Revolutionaries must never be in too much of a hurry or make careless decisions. He who runs when the sun is sleeping will stumble many times. Every time a black freedom fighter is murdered or captured, the pigs try to create the impression that they have squashed the movement, destroyed our forces, and put down the black revolution. The pigs also try to give the impression that 5 or 10 guerrillas are responsible for every revolutionary action carried out in America. That is nonsense. That is absurd. Black revolutionaries do not drop from the moon. We are created by our conditions, shaped by our oppression. We are being manufactured in droves in ghetto streets, places like Attica, San Quentin, Bedford Hills, Leavenworth, and Sing Sing. They are turning out thousands of us. Many jobless black veterans and welfare mothers are joining our ranks. Brothers and sisters from all walks of life who are tired of suffering passively make up the BLA. There is and always will be, until every black man, woman, and child is free, a Black Liberation Army. The main function of the Black Liberation Army at this time is to create good examples to struggle for black freedom and to prepare for the future. We must defend ourselves and let no one disrespect us. We must gain our liberation by any means necessary. It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. In the spirit of Ronald Carter, William Christmas, Mark Clark, Mark Essex, Frank Heavy Fields, Woody Changa Olubala Green, Fred Hampton, Lil Bobby Hutton, George Jackson, Jonathan Jackson, James McLean, Harold Russell, Zaid Malik Shakur, Anthony Kimu Olubala White, we must fight on. July 6, 1973, Middlesex County Workhouse. So this is like something she wrote while she was in prison. And again, when we talk about media literacy, we've had this conversation before on here. We have to choose our heroes, and our children have to be able to identify who their heroes should be. Like, even just reading that, I feel empowered.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I think people listening to that would feel empowered too. So we have to look at like what the examples are that were given by the mainstream media, popular culture, the commercial rap music machine, and say, okay, well, what type of black women are they giving to us?
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Right.
And what type of black woman was Assata Shakur? And we also have to be clear about, you know, sometimes we cannot be both. Sometimes there is either or. I know in the African tradition, we often are both and both and is important. However, there are times when our ancestors, even in our traditional systems and our traditional epistemology, we did draw lines in the sand and say, no, you're either this or that, mm-hmm. right? So we're not going to be like, you know, Meg Thee Stallion and Assata Shakur at the same time.
Right.
We're not going to be Cardi B and Assata Shakur at the same time. We read what she wrote and what she was talking about, and there's an ideology that's being promoted, anti-colonial. We're anti-colonial struggle, you know, anti-oppression. You know, we need money for, you know, food, clothes, and shelter. That's fine. But, you know, certain people are putting out certain messages and, you know, everything is not the same. So I think we definitely got to think about those things. And, you know, and this is, and again, you know, even in terms of men, same thing, you know, like she mentioned Sundiata Kolee. You know, Sundiata Kolee writes in this pamphlet as well. Zaid Malik Shakur wrote in this pamphlet as well. So we think about the men that are promoted to us by, you know, popular culture, mainstream media, the commercial rap music machine. And what are they telling us to do? What are they telling our young people to do? But what were these black men telling our young people to do and telling people to do? You know, and who is alive today still, you know, cut of that same cloth? You know, but these are the conversations that we have to have in the community. And we have to expose our own contradictions, you know, especially when we think about, I was talking to the brother Marcus Klein, who does good work, you know, as independent schools, you know, in Chicago, Freedom Home Academy. And he posted information about the Black Liberation Army. And one of the things that they would do is they would go to war with the drug dealers, you know. So we think of, and it made me think about when he posted that information, it made me think about how, okay, well, Asada Shakur was part and parcel of that. Matter of fact, she got a charge. She got a charge for allegedly, you know, robbing this drug dealer. The charge was dismissed. But I believe that was in connection to part of the activities that the Black Liberation Army wanted to go, because they knew the scourge and the problem that drug activity had on the Black community.
Mm-hmm.
But nowadays it's like we have people, because of our own lack of awareness, we'll celebrate the commercial rapper that will glorify and tell stories about being a drug dealer or aspirations of becoming a drug kingpin. But at the same time, we feel as though we can celebrate Asada Shakur as well. But Asada Shakur was part of the Black Liberation Army, who made it their point to go to war with and attack these type of Black men that were doing this work.
And see,
so these are conversations we have to have. We have to expose these contradictions.
Right, and that's the point. We have to expose the contradictions. I'm of the contention that we got to, you know, draw a line in the sand. You know, just like for me, I don't use the word Black, nor do I use the word white. Nor do I use the word white, because number one, we're not Black, and Europeans, Caucasians aren't white. You know, and in fact, the problem is that people that we use Black because we don't want to be African. Then some of the people don't want to be white, like Steve Harvey or Stephen A. Smith. I use them as examples all the time, because those cats, they love America. They love capitalism. They love the style. They love, you know, they can live. Like here in Atlanta, you can live in a subdivision that's all us, you know. But yet, in that subdivision, there is nothing that those brothers and sisters who live there to put their money together to build a strip mall so they can have a supermarket, so they can have businesses that their children could be employed in, you know. It's all the time just wanting to be with what the Europeans done. I want his cars. I want his jobs. I want his women. I want to live the way he does. I don't want to be white, but I'm Black. But I sure in hell don't want to be African. You see? And so to me, there has to come a time where we say either you're in or you're out. You know? Either you're going to be with us in the struggle or you're out. And so we can move on, because we're constantly trying to educate our people and talking to them about the issues that affect them. And they know it. Some don't want to know it. Some don't want to acknowledge it, because it's there. It's always been there. It's been there for hundreds of years. But they feel that somehow, some way, that Europeans will have some kind of epiphany and then will say, well, I'm really sorry. And here's some reparations. And I know that just recently, I think it's Evanston, Illinois, where Northwestern University is. I think that city has approved a reparations package.
I've heard of it. Yeah, I've heard of that. Yeah.
And research that more. Right. And honestly, for me, I'm against it.
Hmm.
I'm against that. I'm damn sure. Down with reparations, because not to get something from the European who has done to us what they have done to us, and especially it does a dishonor and disservice to our ancestors who suffered tremendously. So no, I'm down with that, but I'm not down with just giving us some money, because that's just like what you just received the last few days ago, a stimulus package, because that's all it is, you know. And I've seen the piece on Evanston where those brothers and sisters clearly have been marginalized. And, of course, they were put in these tracks, you know, the redlining. They were making sure that when you came into Evanston, you could only move here. And in this area, all these homes were always devalued. You couldn't live here, you know. So I understand that. And of course, they lost a lot. I understand that. It's just like brothers and sisters who have suffered for generations in the welfare system. You know, I understand these things. But to me, what's most important is reparations needs to be to repair us institutionally. That's what reparation means, to repair. And we need institutions. We need institutions that we control, that nobody outside of us. And I say that they got the funding, give up the funding, give up the materials, give up whatever equipment is necessary for us to run our own schools, for us to develop some production or whatever. You see, because see, there's this Caucasian, I say this many times on this program about reparations. There's this Caucasian named Charles Cuthammer, who was a editorialist. I can't remember if he was with New York Daily News or whoever at the time, or Washington Post, whatever. But about, I'd say, in the 80s, early 80s, maybe even in the late 70s, he had an editorial talking about we should give them reparations. He was making reference to affirmative action, which was very big at the time. You know, because I came on the fire department through affirmative action. You know, many other jobs that brothers had in the police department. Many universities were initiating affirmative action programs. So we had affirmative action. We had welfare. We had other social programs. He said, yeah, we should give them reparations. You know, just give an example. 20,000 individual and 40,000 a family, whatever, you know, because the lack of knowledge of self and the ability to come and pull resources, it'll be like a stimulus package, you know, big Cadillac sales, you know, gold and diamonds and stuff, you know, all of these things will be happening. They won't pull these money together. They won't establish schools and businesses and so forth. They won't do that. And then after you give them reparations, we'll get that money back within a year. And then now, there ain't a damn thing that you can say. If we discriminate against you, there ain't going to be no class actions. No class actions. None of that. If you felt you discriminated and you can't prove, you have no corroborating evidence, you can't prove, the hell with you. Throw it out. And so now we can discriminate indiscriminately. As they always have, you know. So, you know, I'm down with reparations. You know, I'm not down with ADOS, and that's foolishness, that divisiveness, you know. But I'm down with reparations as it happens globally. Because to me, by trying to establish some reparations with various countries and regions, no, we should do this as a people. We need to unify as a people. These people owe us. They have done a tremendous harm. They have done something that is against all humanity. In fact, let me play this. Let me play this. Let me see if I can find this. Because this is another piece, I think, that, and let me see where did I get this from. But this is a deep piece, man. And
who's it by?
Huh? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Who's it? Who's the author? Who's
you know what? I don't know. It sounds like it's a Caucasian, who is it's a Caucasian, but here's the piece.
Okay.
Important historical facts. Underscore things seriously about THIS underscore. The black African, the wretched of the earth, is the only member of the human race who has been brainwashed to think that his ancestors bequeathed him with a curse that has prevented him from attaining aspired goals and life desires. Almost every misfortune he encounters on earth is the fault of some ancestors, who must be bound and cast with the fire of the Holy Ghost in the name of Jesus. The white people don't have terrible ancestors who have done terrible things. No. It's only the black ancestor. Over the years, the black ancestor has been so vilified by Christians they pay tithes, stay up all night, fast and pray to destroy the African ancestor in the name of Jesus. The black ancestor is so wicked he cursed his own kids. Having cursed his ancestor who gave him life, the black man is roaming around the world like a tortoise without a shell. He has no backbone. Zero identity. Thus no race respects him. He's lynched in Malaysia, incarcerated in Cambodia. He's shot like a dog in the streets of America. In Europe, he cleans the white man's shit. And they spit on him. Why won't they? A man who hates himself and despises his roots deserves no respect whatsoever. John Hawkins was a foremost English slave trader, a thief, and by contemporary moral standards, he can as well be called a terrorist. John Hawkins made three trips to West Africa in the 1560s and stole Africans whom he sold to the Spanish in America. On returning to England after the first trip, his profit was so handsome that Queen Elizabeth I became interested in directly participating in his next venture, and she provided for that purpose a ship named Jesus. Hawkins left with Jesus to steal some more Africans, and he returned to England with such dividends that Queen Elizabeth made him a knight. Hawkins chose as his coat of arms the representation of an African in chains. Today the generations of Hawkins and Queen Elizabeth I are alive, and enjoying life from the proceeds of their evil ancestors. They don't demonize their ancestors despite their active involvement in the greatest evil humanity has ever witnessed. Both individuals sanction rape, kidnapping, and mass murder, but their children don't bear ancestral curses like black Africans. You'd be hard-pressed to see a member of the British elite publicly denounce slavery. Isn't it time to emancipate yourself from mental slavery, O ye Negro? If ancestral curse exists, who should suffer from it? The ancestor who kidnapped and raped and murdered and pillaged and stole and enslaved his fellow man, or the man whose freedom was taken from him? Surely, the man who threw pregnant Negro women to sharks at sea because they were too weak deserves his future generations to suffer, and not the man whose society was so pure they had no prisons to punish offenders. Do these black Africans who will go to church today binding and casting ancestral curses know that almost all the top British politicians from the 17th century till the 19th century were proud slave merchants? It is on record that 15 Lord Mayors of London, 25 sheriffs, and 38 aldermen of the City of London were shareholders in the Royal Africa Company, RAC, between 1660 to 1690. The RAC alone was responsible for trafficking over 1.5 million Negroes to Britain and twice that number to the Caribbean. David and Alexander Barclays were active participants in the kidnapping and enslavement of millions of black Africans. As was standard practice at the time, the risky and long-term nature of transatlantic slave trading required new banking houses that could offer credits to prospective slave traders for periods of between 1.5 to 3 years. One bank that provided this service was run by Alexander and David Barclay. Their bank still carries their name. The Barclays Bank is also a proud sponsor of the English Premier League that me and you are fanatical fans of Chelsea and Arsenal and Man United today. Their children don't bind and cast their ancestral evil, rather it is the Negro whose ancestors were dehumanized and tortured and enslaved, that keeps praying against ancestral curses. The Bank of England was also involved in the slave trade. Sir Richard Neves, who was the director of the bank for 48 years, was also the chairman of the Society of West India Merchants. A group of vile men who stole Africans and made handsome profits by selling them onto farmers who needed them to work in their sugar and tobacco plantations in the West Indies. Today, Liverpool Football Club will be playing Tottenham Hotspur in the Barclays Premier League. Pay attention. How many of you who are Liverpool supporters today know that the initial founders of that football club were retired slave traders, whom in 1892, with slavery outlawed, decided to invest their money in a football club that will reap future rewards for their generations to come via a bank called Arthur Haywood & Sons & Company. That bank would be absorbed in turn by the Bank of Liverpool, Martin's Bank, and Barclays Bank. You watch them and shout in ecstasy when they score. But a pastor somewhere will tell you the reason you're poor is because your ancestors committed evil, hence the reason you experience ill luck. And you will believe and start casting and binding rubbish. For your information, Liverpool was a major port for the transatlantic slave trade. Slave ships were often built or repaired in Liverpool. Nearly 1.5 million Africans were forcibly transported across the Atlantic in Liverpool ships. The Liverpool Merchant was the first recorded slave ship to sail from Liverpool. She set sail on October 3, 1699, and arrived in Barbados on September 18, 1700 with a cargo of 220 enslaved Africans. Part owner Sir Thomas Johnson is known as the founder of modern Liverpool. Liverpool City wouldn't be what it is today without the trade in black Africans. The personal and civic wealth gained from slaving cemented the foundations for the Liverpool's future growth. The children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the perpetrators of this monstrosity against the black man enjoy heaven here on earth and live in more stable environment. They have managed to stabilize their society and solve their problem and live in relative peace. But the Negro ancestors, the wretched of the earth, who was kidnapped and his freedom forcefully taken away from him, he was sentenced to a plantation for the rest of his life. It is this ancestor in bed many others who is demonized by Christians as having bequeathed their offsprings with curses. This is a historical fact our African brothers and sisters should be aware of. Africans unite, Shooting Star.
Yeah, what'd you think of that, man?
I mean, it just exposes a lot of the history.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
A lot of things we're talking about. We talk about on a regular basis, like the economic aspect of, you know, our oppression and how, you know, it's a zero-sum game. Somebody gains while we have lost.
Yeah.
Are there any callers? Any callers that waiting in the queue?
Brothers and sisters, there are a number of people in the queue. And, of course, if you hit star twice, you can join this conversation or just dial 215-490-9832. 215-490-9832. Hit star twice, and you can join the conversation. And nobody's done it. Oh, yeah.
I also wanted to talk about some of her famous quotes.
Okay. You know? Hold on. We got a caller. 267-616-267.
Good afternoon. How you guys doing today?
Doing well, brother. How you doing? Good.
I'm doing well. I'm appreciating the lesson that you guys are bringing forth. I tried to punch your number in earlier, but I couldn't get in. But all points that you gentlemen are sharing relevant to past in the present situation that we currently going through, and you know just encourage that it's coming forth, and hope that other listeners out there on the airwaves, you know, are able to take it in and take it out to the community and put it in motion, whether it's their professional, their personal, or their familial lifestyle. Let me see. One of the things that was mentioned earlier, I think it was like with medical apartheid, Brother Parker was talking about how like Europeans will create definitions, and then those definitions that end up, we'll end up embracing those in different ways. And one of the things that I feel like is prevalent in the community is, I say, understanding the mental health situation. So give or take, we'll have certain experiences or exposures. And then it's like the culmination of those experiences is, okay, now you're in a deficit mentally. And now we can put a label on you and we can be able to identify you this way. And so it's like I constantly see professionals also embracing those labels on other community members. So it's like community members will have had an experience. However, what's been taken from the community member is their ability to identify, describe, and evaluate what it is they experienced, because it's like they run a monopoly on identifying and defining phenomena at the university level. And so when one person that will attempt to speak, it's like, okay, it's almost anecdotal, but then it's like millions of other folks that can relate to that same experience.
Okay. Brother Akil?
That's my good brother, Courtney, who works in the streets with the people here in Philly. Youth that are housing insecure. So he's been saying that for years. We actually used to teach together. So these are some of the conversations that, you know, we would have in the past. And, you know, he makes a good point about, you know, mental health. And when he's speaking, it makes me think about, like, the fact that there's a lot of attention given toward mental health. But what he exposes for me is that we need to think more about who's creating the definitions and the standards or the benchmarks for what mental health should be. Because here we have an example from the 19th, you know, be it as it may, from the 19th century or the 18th century, where, you know, the same Europeans, you know, the people that are making the definitions of mental health today, whether it be in the DSM-5 or DSM-6, I don't know what version we're up to at this point in 2021, but who's making the determination? Because once upon a time, your mental health was considered compromised if you thought that you should not be enslaved on a plantation.
Right.
So now we have to think about, and that's why, you know, it's important to study the history, and I think this is what he's exposing and speaking toward, is that Now, when we talk about mental health, because it's very popular and it's very cliche and it's very trendy to, you know, seek out therapy, which people need therapy. I think I need therapy myself. You know what I mean? But so I'm not knocking therapy in and of itself, but we just have to be very careful about what what therapists are telling us and what their training has been for, or else we run into the same situation where, you know, just like 200 years ago, basically it was basically classifying us as crazy if we thought that we didn't belong on a plantation.
Right. And that's why you have, even though they've been trained in these universities, but they understood why they were getting that training, that piece of paper for legitimacy, but they were African-centered in their thought process, like a Naeem Akbar, Wade Nobles, Francis Cress Welsing, and so forth. You know, they were trained. Like
all of these guys and sisters. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
See? Because, see, this whole system is menticide. It's menticidal in its attack on us. So when a good brother or sister goes through the training program, the educational process, and they come out with their degrees, and now they don't want to be associated with their family. They don't want to be associated with the fact of their history and their culture and so forth. They now have been Caucasianized, and they want the jobs. Just like I mentioned before about wanting to be white. They don't want to be African, you know. There ain't no parts of being African. They want the job. They want the money. They want the promotions. They want to live here. You know, they don't want to be African. They don't want to, in essence, they don't want to be white in terms of color. They just want to be white in terms of practice, you see. And to me, that's menticide. You know.
Indeed.
Their minds have been twisted. Their minds have been trained to be alien from themselves and from their people and not to embrace who they are. That's why, to me, the most important thing is, it's like Dr. Clark, who said, we have no friends. Just as this piece I just played to you mentions, all around the world, to this present day, at this very moment, African people are being dogged out for African people who are in China, who are in Japan, who are in Europe, who are in this country, who are in Central and South America, or wherever. And even on the continent, being dogged out by people who are there to try to take the continent over. And the only reason why this continues to happen is because we lack unity. We lack functional unity. Dr. Clark said it best, we have no friends. You want a friend? Go look in the mirror. And don't leave that mirror till you like what you see. I ain't talking about your cleft chin or dimples in your damn cheeks or the shape of your nose. I'm saying like who you see culturally, historically, like your dark skin, like your close curled hair, like your thick lips and so forth. But like it when you see others. Embrace that. Embrace that culture. And that's the problem that we have. We've been trained to hate ourselves. We've been trained, just as that piece I just played to you, trained to believe that we are cursed. When I saw that piece with Minister Farrakhan talking about we're cursed, we're not cursed. And no, we shouldn't like to have hair on our head like we have on our damn eyebrows. No, we're not cursed. Believing that we are the sons of Ham, and Ham was cursed because he saw his father Noah naked after landing and building a vineyard and so forth, and then did not cover his father's nakedness. His two brothers walked backwards so they did not see their father's nakedness. And then when he came out of that drunken stupor and found out what had happened, he curses Ham to be servants unto his brothers. So the Europeans and the Arabs, they take this biblical context to justify the enslavement of African people. And of course we, because we have embraced Christianity to the hilt, we believe it, and it's detrimental to us. So I'm saying, you know, if anybody wants to join this conversation, hit star twice, who are in the queue, hit star twice, you can get in.
I wanna highlight two very essential Assata Shakur quotes.
Okay.
The first one being, being this: nobody in the world, nobody in history has ever gotten their freedom by appealing to the moral sense of the people who were oppressing them. That's quote number one. And quote number two, I think this also speaks to what you were just saying. No one is going to give you the education you need to overthrow them. Nobody is going to teach you your true history, teach you your true heroes, if they know that that knowledge will help set you free.
That's right.
And this is what I was thought. That's quote number two. So this is what I was talking about in terms of when I read her autobiography, which I recommend to everybody that's listening. Right. And everybody that's listening, I want you to recommend it to everybody that you know. And it just keeps going and going like that. Right. Is that, you know, neo-colonial schooling, right? Neo-colonial schooling. Mm. You know, it's a necessary evil at this point. Right. You can learn some valuable skills in the neo-colonial schools, in the public schools, charter schools, whatever they may be, even if it's a parochial school, you can learn some valuable skills, but that's not it. That's not what it is. We got to be providing more and different education outside of those spaces. And really, my goal is to try to work toward creating a situation where if those public schools and those charter schools and those parochial schools are necessary at all, they should only be spaces for practice, for academic practice. That's it. They should be spaces for academic practice and for our children to go and learn how to interact with other ethnic groups and other racial groups without being subordinate to them.
That's right.
People talk about wanting to sit at the table. If you want to sit at the table, we have to have at a minimum equal amounts of power, right, at that table. We shouldn't be like, you know, like these other groups sitting at the table in their respective seats, and we're like walking up to the table like a dog
begging for crumbs.
Looking to each group to say, okay, well, you know, are the Asians going to give me some scraps? Or are the Europeans going to give me some scraps? Or the Ashkenazi Jews going to give me some scraps? That's pretty much how we're positioned right now. Mm-hmm. So, but we have to, as a community, create the educational space and the educational opportunities and the infrastructure so that our children are educated in the home, primarily in the home, and by community members. Even if we utilize the internet resources and, you know, YouTube lessons and whatnot. So when they go into those spaces, whether they be virtual or when schools open back up and the brick and mortar classroom structure is reestablished, that, you know, they're going there to practice, you know, because then it makes those racist teachers, you know, mm-hmm. less relevant. You know, it's like they become just a necessary evil because, you know, learning is a very vulnerable experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if I know that you don't like me, I know that you don't respect my humanity. If I can sense it, even if I can't articulate it as a child or as a student. It's going to be very difficult for me to learn a challenging topic from you, you know. So I think, but that's what we have to do, and in these spaces, a lot of times, regardless of how well-meaning the teacher might be, if they're part of a system, and you know, part of a larger educational structure that is anti-black and anti-African. And it's still going to be, you know, very hard to, you know, learn and really advance. And again, this is something that, you know, Asada Shakur speaks to. And this is why it's not accidental that, you know, we don't learn about, you know, people like Asada Shakur in school, unless you had that one teacher who just happened to be exposed to this sister and, you know, in this type of, you know, black radical tradition and whatnot, and actually cares. Right.
Right.
And then even when some people are exposed, we got to be careful with that too, because we got to look at, again, with the historiography, like what is being included in the conversation. Because, you know, a lot of people, I mean, I would say Malcolm X is mainstream in a lot of schools. A lot of people talk about Malcolm. What do they talk about? You know, what specifically are they talking about Malcolm? What type of historical revisionism is taking place?
Right. We got a caller. We got a caller, 646-646. And the caller from... Hey, what's up?
OT and Brother Akil. How y'all brothers doing?
Brother Jay, we're doing well.
Doing good.
What about you, Brother Jay? Go ahead.
Hey, listen, you know, the reality is white folks, and whatever they do to us, they have the right to do it because it's the boss that pays the cost to keep you enslaved to them. It's your job to break that chain. Unfortunately, black people haven't really defined what breaking that chain is. So that's why you have totally different fractions in thought. You know what I mean? Black people don't understand, well, not all, but some black people don't understand that you have to die for freedom and liberation. You can't just go about the business of asking a cracker to be nice to you, to treat you with respect. You got to demand that the cracker treat you with respect. I mean, you know, you were talking earlier about Kahnhammer. I have to agree with Kahnhammer. If you're dealing with the business at hand, if you're trying to change the perspective and the narrative, yeah, I would have given us money too. Because the way the system is set up, definitely you would get it back. And then, like he said, you couldn't ask them for nothing no more. But the problem is, those in our community haven't gotten to the point or the ability to educate our people to change that train of thought, giving it back to the cracker. You know what I mean? We're the only people, I believe, at this time, that is used by other ethnic groups to move forward their liberation. They come into our community. We can't go in their community. They bring us inferior products, and they become rich off of us. And then the reality is we want to bitch and moan about it. No, just stop purchasing from them damn devils. But we don't have leadership that would push forward that type of narrative, because then the daddy go say you being diverse. Then the daddy go say you being reverse racist. Or whatever type of bullshit they come up with to quell down the people. But hey, until you get to that point, let's just keep it real. You're going to continuously have this problem. You got to be able to change the mindset of the people in order for them to move forward. Unfortunately.
I hear you.
Unfortunately.
All right, Jay.
We haven't figured it out yet.
Yep. All right, Jay. So, 267. Good afternoon. You're on with Akil Parker.
Good afternoon, hey. Brother Akil. Good afternoon, OC.
Hey, what's up, man? What's up, Ralph? How you doing?
I know we're at the end of the program, so I'm keep it real short. You know, Brother Akil said something that was very, very basic, but major. He said, "I myself need therapy," and you know what? That takes a lot of courage and a lot of humility to say something like that, because that's where we're at, man. All of us need some kind of therapy to rechange our thinking. Just like Jay was just saying, we embrace victimhood. We got to get rid of that kind of thinking, man. If we're going to keep embracing victimhood, we're this, we're that, instead of working on changing our thinking. You know, and that's where it's at, man. Even that tape you played earlier of that Englishman or whatever he was talking about us, the whole thing he talked about was our thinking and the way we view ourselves, man.
Right.
So until we get a grip on that, the denial factor, and really getting some real honest help. That's why I miss brothers like Dr. Amos Wilson, because he dealt directly with the psychosis of our folks, man. And until we get leaders like that, we're going to continue doing the same nonsense over and over and over. I'm in my 60s now, and I'm sick of it. You know what I mean?
Well,
so, all right, go ahead. We got to get rid of our arrogance and our pride, man.
No,
we got to get rid of that.
I agree, Ralph, but the overall thinking for us in this country and elsewhere, even on the continent, is that Caucasians ain't that bad. Let's try to continue to appeal to them. Let's wear their ass down with morality and hope and moral persuasion. Let's wear their ass down with it. You know, tell them about their Bible, you know, that all men are created equal and all that kind of bullshit. So it is not about them. It is about us. But we keep trying to appeal to them because they're in control. But our lack of understanding how it affects us. You see,
right.
We got a whole bunch of callers here now, Brother Q.
Hey, hey, extended an hour, man, because that propaganda is strong, my brother.
Yeah.
It's very strong.
Well, I'm going to go over.
I'm gonna hang up and I'm gonna continue listening, brother Oshie.
Appreciate it.
I just had to get that one in there.
Right on, brother Ralph. Appreciate that. 478. Good afternoon.
Peace, family. It's Sincere. How y'all doing?
Hey, my brother Sincere. How are you doing? Good.
Wonderful. I'm enjoying the conversation, and I definitely felt compelled. I said I was going to sit back and listen today, but my spirit is brewing based on everything I'm hearing.
Right on.
So I heard a couple of brothers say we need leadership, and that model has changed. We've had all of the leadership that we've ever needed from some of the names that y'all named, our great ancestors, the Dr. Creswell Soons, the John Henry Clarks, the Amos Wilsons. Now it's time to do, right? So when we talk about doing, what does that look like? One of the things that I do is put on a free mental health and wellness checkup for my brothers and sisters, and I'm there to make sure that the information has an African center. But we're giving them a diversified information so they can see and experience things on both sides, but we're keeping that balance. Mm. So my charge has come from those ancestors that we talk about, and there's others in the community. So we just have to tap in and make sure that we take advantage of these resources. So that's where we are. The leadership is here. It's always been. It's never gone anywhere. We don't need to elevate a leader. We need to be leaders ourselves and do it in our households and permeate that through our communities.
Yeah, we don't need a charismatic leader. We need a charismatic program and a cadre of leadership. So if the European wants to bump somebody out, like just like they bumped, and I want to thank Sister Susumi, who's listening from Botswana, sent me information about the Tanzanian president who was killed. He was murdered by the Chinese. We'll talk more about that on another program. Brother Akil, you have some comment?
The leadership model is, you know, it's a delicate thing that we got to talk about, because I think, whereas we don't want to like go from one extreme to another, and also we got to look at like what leadership has always looked like in the past, because I think even with some of the people that have been highlighted, like the Dr. Kings and the Malcolms, even they were like, you know, working in small groups at the same time. And I just think that, you know, I mean, you have people like Ella Baker, you know, who was more of an advocate for a more democratic style of leadership. So with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, you have a lot of, you still had a, like people in a leadership position. For example, like at one point, Kwame Ture was the head of SNCC. And at another point, Marion Barry was the head of SNCC. Another point, Imam Jamil Alami, shout out to him, who's still a political prisoner to this right now as we speak. H.R.A.P. Brown was a leader within SNCC. I think leadership is definitely important, and even a more traditional sense of leadership. But I think that we have to have more of a democratic system where people can contribute to the leadership, and people shouldn't have to just kind of. I mean, it's a complex topic. I'd rather, you know, think more about it, actually.
Mm-hmm. It definitely needs
leadership is definitely needed.
Yeah.
It's definitely needed. I think we should be open to exploring and examining different ways of manifesting leadership, you know, and also making sure that we center service, you know, service, like leadership through the form of service, not leadership, whereas, you know, the purpose of leadership is for everyone behind me to just follow and serve me. Like the leader should be serving others. And actually, this is a key point that just came to mind, is that the one of the main responsibilities of the leader and leaders that I think we've kind of not done as good of a job at is training our replacements.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's no succession plans. That's like that in a lot of organizations and churches, because you want to be the leader forever. You know, the bottom line is that we need a charismatic program, not a charismatic leader. We are the leaders that we need. We need something that we're saying this is, because what is our end game? What do we ultimately want to accomplish? For me, and this program that I do every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday is independence, self-determination, liberation, and sovereignty. That is the end game. We say on this program, the motto is Pan-Africanism or perish, unify or die. That is the end game. And so it is not trying to appease or try to reform or try to integrate, assimilate. It's none of that. It is African people finally realizing, stepping up, coming together, pulling resources and doing for ourselves. That's the end game on the continent. When you talk about sovereignty, you can't be sovereign here. There's no doubt about it that the European and the European selfish, greedy nature coming out of his evolutionary development will not share with any damn body. It is proven. And for us to think that somehow we're all in this together, hell no, we ain't all in this together. Never have been and never will be. I'm going to let you have a couple more comments, Brother Akil, or a comment, because I'm over time. So you go ahead and finish this out, brother.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, in honor of, you know, Asada Shakur, you know, I think we need more programs like this, because, you know, we're giving her her flowers, you know, while yep. she's still
right on, living, you know? Right on.
Yep. Not as if, you know, even though she's not, you know, in the United States and we can't, like, go to a, like, a lecture, you know, mm-hmm. by her, you know, and sit in the audience and we watch her talk, you know, we still need to highlight people like her and also, you know, and tell our children about her. You know, tell our children about it. Tell our children about the organizations and the institutions that they helped to promote. And also, you know what, like when she was in the Black Panther Party for self-defense, she was instrumental and she worked in the free breakfast program,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Yeah.
Just the basic and fundamental things, like, you know, just, you know, a grown Black woman, you know, working with grown Black men that were just feeding breakfast to young Black children and also providing cultural and political education while they were doing that first thing in the morning. And those are just the small things that we can do on a regular basis that will, you know, pay such great dividends and that the young people will remember forever, you know, because they're going to remember, you know, yeah. like if I had a dollar for every time, you know, while I've been a teacher here in Philadelphia and, you know, a young brother says, you know, like, you know, my old head told me this or my old head told me that, mm-hmm. you know, that's the type of education that grassroots community education that they were getting in the free breakfast program. And, you know, Asada Shakur was instrumental in that. And, you know, just getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning or getting up, I think in her book, she talks about this, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to be there at 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, I mm-hmm. think it was either in Harlem or in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just that level of commitment, you know, it wasn't like a job, you know, benefits package and all that. You know, they just, the currency was that they were making a contribution to the community and to the collective.
That's right.
You know, and that's why we have to teach young that's people right. to value that. We have to value that ourselves. And, you know, teach young people for that. One of the things I want to say before I go, I would be remiss if I didn't give a shout out to my wife who makes these Canva ads that I, you know, post on social media for these appearances on your show, Baba Oshi. And then, you know, when I'm texting people at the last minute, you know, also sending the Canva ads, you know, so I want to shout out my wife. You know,
please do. It's beautiful. It's great, man. Please do.
You know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Looks good. Yeah. I sent them out because you text me. I sent it out on a text. Got some good response. So right on. Tell her thank you so much. Tell her Sante Sana. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, she's listening. She's listening. Okay. She knows.
I hear you.
Yeah. But you know, in terms of, you know, Asada Shakur and many others like her, I think we have to start thinking about, you know, where do we stand politically? Where do we stand culturally? And we have examples. So I think the key is to just get more information, you know, pick up her book, pick up her autobiography. And there's another book that I recently just found out about called Still Black, Still Strong, which was co-authored by Doruba Bin-Wahad, who also...
Oh, yeah, Doruba, another political prisoner. He was here in the Atlanta area. I think he still might be in the Atlanta area. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and Mumia. So Mumia also co-authored this book. So it was the three of them. And one other book that's also... has information about Asada Shakur in it. Her aunt, Evelyn Williams, was one of her attorneys.
Right.
Her aunt was one of her attorneys. Right. And her aunt wrote a book called Inadmissible Evidence. Inadmissible Evidence. It's the story of the African-American trial lawyer who defended the Black Liberation Army. So, you know, if anyone's interested in the Black Liberation Army, just, you know, doing their due diligence, they can pick up her book. It's called Inadmissible Evidence. And she's an attorney, and she was one of the one of the attorneys for Assad Shakur and, you know, members of the Black Liberation Army. And another thing, too, I would say, because, you know, a lot of our people are, you know, talking about generational wealth and, you know, making money and whatnot, which is not in and of itself, it's not a bad thing. But in the beginning of this book, it talks about how legally Assad Shakur's family had their land stolen. They had land in North Carolina. And when Assad Shakur was growing up, she was born in Queens, New York in 1947, but she spent a lot of time in North Carolina because that's where her family was from. And, you know, they had this beachfront property, right? They had this beachfront property, you know, on the coast, on the coastline, you know, and I think her grandfather had like a restaurant, like, you know, everybody would come out and it was like a club and, you know, nightclub and whatnot. And, you know, but these, you know, these European developers,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
they were like, yo, need that. We need that. So, but they use legal maneuvering.
Sure.
To basically
just like everything else that they've done. Yeah. It's in, you know, all in their favor.
Into real estate as well. Mm-hmm. I would definitely pick up this book, Inadmissible Evidence, because it talks about some of our experiences historically. And because, you know, the other day I made a post about, you know, how can we, like, first, how do houses get stolen? Mm-hmm. And houses get stolen by the deed getting stolen, or, you know, there are different ways. And,
well, they have all the paperwork. They can do whatever the hell they want. It's theirs. Yeah. So all right, dear brother, I got to run. I'm over already, so I got to run. But I appreciate you, and I know you'll be on again real soon. And I love our conversations, Brother Akil. And we'll talk about what we're going to talk about next. Okay? Yep.
All right, brother.
All right, dear brother. Brothers and sisters, we end this program like we end all of our programs with the words of Stephen Biko. The most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the minds of the oppressed. This program is dedicated and committed to helping to free the African mind. But not just the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-D, but the M-I-N-E, because under the feet of African people lies all of the resources that everybody wants, think they can't do without, and they sure in hell, damn it, don't want to pay for. Brothers and sisters, you have a great and wonderful day, a good weekend. Shem Hotep means go in peace. Asante Sana means thank you. Bibi Fahodie means our victorious destiny. Brothers and sisters, we will be victorious. You have a great weekend. Hope you'll come back and see me on Monday, okay? Peace, family.